say the same thing. And so, in order to speak about Krishna, in order to understand the Absolute Truth, let us go to Srimad Bhagavatam. It's the best. I'm skipping many details. It's a very, very... If you want to have a very clinical and detailed and very compelling, convincing set of arguments, why Srimad Bhagavatam is the ultimate authority that one should approach to understand the Absolute Truth, read that Pramana Kanda of Tattva Sandarbha by Jiva Goswami. So that's what Srimad Bhagavatam is. Moreover, now a quick little overview of the beginning parts of Srimad Bhagavatam. I did this in New York and I'll do it again. It's nice, I think, to have a picture of this glorious literature. The first three verses of the first canto, chapter 1, Srimad Bhagavatam, it's like the invocation. It's little sutra-like little expressions of what the message of Srimad Bhagavatam is, and it's an exposition of the Absolute Truth. And it's a commentary on Gayatri Mantra, and it's glorifying Krishna, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Jambat yasya yataha, just as the Vedanta Sutra begins. The Absolute Truth is that from which everything else emanates. And what is that from which everything else emanates? Or what? Whom is it from? This everything that emanates comes? Bhagavan, Krishna, Vasudev, Krishna. So the subject of Srimad Bhagavatam is Vasudev Krishna, and Param Satyam Bhim, he is the highest truth. And so forth. There's some essential sutra-like statements are made that the whole of the Bhagavatam is made up of. And then very essential understanding. The main topic that I want to speak about is also a very essential understanding because it's right at the front end of Srimad Bhagavatam. But I want you to get a picture of this, how Vyasadeva conceived of composing this literature. He presents what is essential for a qualified representative of the Bhagavatam and a qualified recipient of the message of the Bhagavatam. Right at the front end, right at the very, very beginning of the Bhagavatam. Who can properly represent this wonderful literature? And who can receive what it has to offer? It comes in the form of the sages receiving sutta, glorifying sutta, why he's qualified to speak the Bhagavatam, and sutta then appreciates the audience, their qualifications to receive what he has to offer. And then they present six questions, which are essence questions in the whole of the Bhagavatam. And then that's the end of chapter 1, and two chapters of the answers to those six questions. So in the first three chapters we have the essential topics, the Mangalacharna, the sutra-like descriptions, and the qualifications to receive and to transmit this knowledge. Three chapters. Ooh. And then taking the same understanding from the other perspective, from the perspective of the author himself, what is the author intending to say? Vyasadeva presents in the next three chapters. He's the author. So he gives a description of how he compiled the Vedas. In each end of Dwarpa Yuga, in each of the four Yuga cycles, just preceding the beginning of Kali Yuga, someone, an empowered personality, performs this function of taking the Vedas that are present in sound and puts them in a written form because Kali Yuga people can't remember. It has to be written. As Prabhupada taught us, the best way to remember something Write it down. Oh, Vyasa wrote it down. Because people can't remember. They can't even remember to write it down. Or to look where they wrote it down. Let's see, where did I leave that? Oh, yeah. So, Vyasa describes as dividing the Vedas into four, and then the Vedanta Sutra, and then the Smritis, the Itihasas, and the Puranas, and his feeling dissatisfied. I was thinking like this. Supposing somebody here spent a long stretch of time. Almost like over there, there's a little award that Shruti won for getting straight A's in her last year of middle school. Let's hear it from Shruti. Straight A's in middle school. And so, at the end of getting straight A's in middle school, she is just feeling, I'm not feeling satisfied. There's something missing. I want to think of academic things. Supposing someone here is working on Bhakti Shastri. So you complete your study of Bhagavad Gita and Nectar of Devotion and Ishopanishad and Nectar of Instruction. You take the exam, straight A's in the exam. And at the end, you're feeling dissatisfied. Because Krishna consciousness is not just an intellectual, informational thing, it's a transformational thing. And so, Vyasa, what to speak of Bhakti Shastri, he compiled all the Vedas. And he's feeling dissatisfied, wondering, what's going on? Why am I feeling like this? And in comes Narada Muni, his spiritual master, to let him know what he missed. He got an A in his exam, but he didn't sufficiently glorify the personality of Godhead, which is the subject of Srimad Bhagavatam, the absolute truth, the personality, the Bhagavan feature of the absolute truth. He did not sufficiently glorify and highlight. And so he gives him an instruction. Compile such a literature, you should do what I did. Don't just do as I say. Do as I do. And then Narada described how he realized the absolute truth in full. He gives his whole autobiography of Narada Muni. From his previous lifetime, and his previous lifetime was in a previous kalpa, a previous day of Brahma. The whole night of Brahma had passed before he became Narada at the beginning of the day of our present Lord Brahma. That's very fascinating. Narada, how does one go from obscurity to perfection? That's important to understand in Srimad Bhagavatam, isn't it? Because that's our position. Who are we? And what are we looking for? The topmost thing. That chance, right? Yes! Because look at the example of Narada Muni. Completely an obscure nothing. Practically an orphan. Without even having an orphanage. No father. Then his mother died too, and in a Sudra family, no education. No money, no position, no nothing. Didn't have a visa or a passport either. Ticket to America, didn't have any of those things. But he achieved spiritual perfection and how did he do that? So that's described. Namely, it's the combination of mercy and his eagerness for that mercy. And how, that there's particulars of how he received that mercy and applied that mercy that he received and achieve spiritual perfection. So basically that ends the first six chapters, from how not Vyas compiled the Vedas, how he was instructed to write Srimad Bhagavatam, what the purpose of the Bhagavatam is, and the qualification of Vyas to do it, and the descending mercy that he got from Narada to empower him to do it. And then the beginning of chapter 7 is, he did it. It was a two-part instruction. Engage yourself in complete absorption in nothing but the personality of God, and in trance, you'll get a realization. And then part 2 is, whatever that realization is, you write the literature that describes the essence of that realization. What's the essence of Srimad Bhagavatam? It's complete concentration of the mind upon the personality of Godhead. And in that state where there's no material taint, what is that literature like? That's the Srimad Bhagavatam. And so then he describes in four verses, very important verses, 1-7, I think it's 4-7, what his realization was, what he saw, what he experienced, what he realized from what he saw and experienced. He saw the personality of God, he saw the whole spiritual world, and all the parts of the spiritual world, the living entities, and their different position between being in the material and being in the spiritual position. Again, very essence consideration. How do we move from the material to the spiritual position? What's the difference between the two? Principles he was describing. He realized. And then he compiled Srimad Bhagavatam. Specifically for the purpose of moving the conditioned soul to the liberated position, fixed upon the personality of Godhead. And then, when he taught that, after compiling, he wanted to preserve the literature by teaching it to his son, Shukadeva. And then the sages hearing this say, wait, time out, what's going on? Shukadeva Goswami was a liberated soul. He has no interest in anything material. Why did he take the trouble to go to school, to learn something? He doesn't need anything. And the response is exactly, because the Srimad Bhagavatam is not material. It's not something that you go to school to learn. It's something that is the essence of the absolute truth, and fully self-realized transcendentalists are attracted to this literature. This is Paramahamsa literature, Mahabhagavata literature. This Srimad Bhagavatam that we can go to our bookstore, to the Govinda's gift store, any temple, and say, I'd like a set of Srimad Bhagavatams, please. The absolute truth compiled by the perfected realization of Vyasadeva and then narrated by his divine son, Shukadeva Goswami, making it even more relishable because it was touched by the lips of Shukadeva Goswami. What qualification do we have? Lots of mercy coming. And what is our eagerness? What's the qualification for receiving that wonderful message? It's the eagerness. Even we're shameless, we have no qualification, we're eager. That's what Rupa Goswami describes in his, those of you that are studying Nectar Devotion. He writes one verse where he says, I'm shameless, I have no qualification, I have no good education, I have no good birth, I have no good qualities, I'm nobody, nothing, nowhere, but I'm shameless. I want the mercy of Krishna. And I know that he's very merciful, and so I'm crying out, please give your mercy, although I have no qualification for it. Please give your mercy. Eagerness for the mercy of Krishna. So that's Srimad Bhagavatam, is the manifestation of Krishna's mercy in this age of Kali. It's one of the six questions going back to the first chapter, one of the last of the six questions, because Srimad Bhagavatam was spoken just after Kali Yuga began. It's spoken just after Krishna's departure. Because when Krishna's departure took place, very quickly, that little sundi, little juncture of time, Kali Yuga began. And the sages knew that Kali Yuga had begun, and they were very concerned. Because their question to Sutta Goswami was, when Krishna was present, just by the touch of his feet on this planet, everything was auspicious. Everything that everybody required, materially and spiritually, was automatically there. Mother Earth, who was overburdened by the demoniac kings, immediately became very joyful. Prosperity, peace, tranquility, everything auspicious was present when Krishna was present. And now we see the signs of inauspiciousness. Kali Yuga has begun, and it's a tsunami.
Kali Yuga is terrible.
What can be done now that Krishna has left the planet? Where can one find shelter in religious principles for the upliftment and well-being of the world? And the answer that's given is Srimad Bhagavatam has appeared. Just after, like, a metaphor is used, like the setting of the sun on the western horizon, and the darkness of the night has begun. Just after the setting of the disappearance of Krishna has arisen the sun-like, giving as brilliant as the sun, but as soothing as the rays of the moon. Such poetry. Because the light of the sun gives lots of light, but it's hot and scorching sometimes. But the moon is very soothing. So similarly, Krishna, when he came, he killed so many demons, and he set wrongs right, and he left. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is there in this age of Kali, where everything is topsy-turvy, and up is down, and down is up, and things are crazy, and getting more crazy. If you haven't noticed, I've noticed. One can call, just sit with any teenager and ask them what's crazy in this world, and they'll tell you the power is what's crazy in this world. It doesn't take a bright person to see what's crazy. So many crazy things. What to do? The Srimad Bhagavatam is the answer that's given by Sutta Goswami. Religious principles, the re-establishing the proper balance of virtue in this world. And what will sustain that virtue in this world is fixing one's consciousness upon the absolute truth, the personality, Godhead, and pure devotion. What's the means for that? The Srimad Bhagavatam is the means for that. It's specifically with that design. And who is the person eligible to receive that? Anyone who's eager for it. On the far end, the Mahabhagavatas, the fully liberated souls, they can receive great joy from the Srimad Bhagavatam. And on the other end, those persons who are completely unregulated and sinful, Janata Agha, the sinful people of this world, and everybody in between, all the perfect persons that aren't Mahabhagavatas and aren't completely sinful. That's most of us. We're somewhere in between those two positions. The Bhagavatam is for everyone. Just as the full moon, the brilliant rays of the Bhagavatam shed its light upon everyone. So after hearing all of this, this Srimad Bhagavatam is this narration that describes the absolute truth that's meant for the stage of Kali to give light to all the people. And it's just topics about Krishna. Tell us about Krishna! And then the Bhagavatam begins. In chapter 7. And so this is, for those of you that came to New York, you've heard this already. It's nice to hear that. The topics that Vyas chooses at the very beginning, starting in the 7th chapter and then in the 8th chapter, it's not chronological, but it's systematic. It's very, the topics are very selectively chosen topics to understand. It's where attention really needs to get absorbed in understanding these front end topics. They lead into Krishna Katha. They are connected to Krishna Katha because they're in relation to Krishna. They're the devotees of Krishna. Chapter 7 is about Arjuna and his encounter with Ashwatthama. Ashwatthama's heinous activity of killing the sleeping sons of Draupadi and what Arjuna does in response to that. And then what Ashwatthama does in response to Arjuna's response, he's afraid for his life. And what consciousness does he take shelter of? So he releases a Brahmastra, and then Arjuna's life is at risk. And what's the consciousness of Arjuna when his life is at risk? Where does his consciousness go to? What is his shelter? What's the difference? In this age of Kali, there's all kinds of problems. Again, if you haven't noticed. There's all kinds of problems. And they keep coming. Waves and waves and waves of stuff. It doesn't stop. Now and then it gets a little quieter. And then it comes on again. What do you do? What's your shelter? Where does your consciousness go to take shelter? And the contrasting position is a very elevated intellectual Brahmin Ashwatthama non-devotee. He takes shelter of slick tricks and firing of Brahmastras to save himself. And what Arjuna does is he turns to Krishna because he's a devotee. And guess which prevails? The devotee. Because he has Krishna on his side. As Arjuna says, Krishna, you're in control of all energies. You create them. They're under your direction. What to speak of a little puny Brahmastra? All energies, spiritual material, are under your direction. I take shelter of you. He didn't have to think about it. It was a life-threatening situation. He didn't have to think about it. Somebody just sent me a little thing that personal essay they wrote about being bugged in the streets of New York. I don't want people to be afraid to go to New York or anything, because you can get mugged in Chicago too. But, you know, what was their realization? As the thing was happening and after the thing happened, and it doesn't have to be something so radical as that, but at any time we're confronted with some feature of the material energy that it's, you know, we're not ready for it. It happens, right? Mm-hmm. Looking around the room and thinking of some situations where it happens. It happens to all of us or those that are very dear to us. And what is our shelter? It's an important lesson. Right at the front of the narration of Srimad Bhagavatam. We could say, the narration of Srimad Bhagavatam begins in chapter 7. The other is preparing us. And in chapter 8, same theme. Only this time it's not Arjuna, it's Queen Kunti. So Prabhupada said on many occasions, when Krishna came, supposing Krishna walked in the room, even Jambavan, he didn't recognize Krishna. He was a great devotee. But because Jambavan was attached to a stupid jewel. A stupid jewel. It wasn't a smart jewel, it was a stupid one. It was one that just gave gold and did things like that. And so he was all attached. He didn't even recognize Krishna. He's a great devotee. He didn't recognize Krishna. Someone's at the door and they should... Did you put a sign up there?
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Small sign over here.
Prabhupada said that a couple, a handful of people only understood who was Krishna. And there's one handful of the Pandavas themselves. And of course, Uddhava, he understood, and Bhishma, he understood. And we probably didn't severely restrict it to 10 only, but very limited. Even in direct face-to-face contact with Krishna, not so many people understood who Krishna really was. Kunti was one who understood who Krishna was, although she felt herself not qualified, as she says in her prayers. How can, if the great sages and great rishis and the most learned demigods, they don't understand, how can a woman like me understand? But she understands. She's just feeling very humble. That's one of her qualifications to understand. I'm not proud of her high position. She's very devoted to Krishna. So now I want to discuss a little in-between topic and then the main topic. An in-between topic is the feature of Krishna in Vaikuntha, or Lord Narayan of Vaikuntha, and the feature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead when he appears in this world, performing his various pastimes. So in the spiritual world, in Vaikuntha, the Lord manifests his Aishvarya feature. He's Bhagavan. He has all opulences in full. He is just like our children perform this presentation on the opulences of the Absolute previous year. He is the source of all. What to speak of material opulences are just a spark of his splendor. It's a reflection of the blazing fire of Krishna, who in the spiritual world manifests the fullness of all opulences. And the fullness of all opulences is so awesome that the mood in Vaikuntha is awe and reverence, veneration. As Krishna, as Narayan is manifesting his Aishvarya Bhav. But when Narayan descends to this world, or the personality of Godhead comes to this world and performs his Bhoma Lila, there are relationships that exist that are even more relishable than those relationships in Vaikuntha. For the Lord himself and for his devotee. So, in Dwaraka, they understand Krishna as the personality of Godhead, and the where he manifests all of his opulences fully, therefore it's Dwaraka. But he has very confidential relatives, the Yadus and the Vrishnis. And they have intimate contact with Krishna. Intimate contact with Krishna. And amongst all of those who have intimate contact with Krishna, Uddhava has the most intimate contact with Krishna. But even more in the form of intimacy are the residents of Mathura, Vasudeva and Devaki, and the residents in Mathura who associate with Krishna. Kunti's a little bit in that category too, because she understands Krishna's opulence, just like, say, Vasudeva and Devaki. When Krishna appeared in the prison house of Kamsa, he showed his four-armed form. Club, conch, disc, lotus. I'm the Supreme Lord. I want you to know that I'm not just your child. Then he assumed the form of a child. So their parental affections could be present, but parental affection where they understood cognitively, very, very clearly, this is the Supreme Lord. It's not just my cuddly little child. But then their parental affection was so strong, the madhurya feature of Krishna's appearance in this world was so strong, that they were, to a certain degree, it eclipsed his Aishwarya feature. Devaki requested, "Oh, Supreme Lord, please assume a childlike form, because if Kamsa hears that my eighth child has appeared, he'll come and quickly try to kill you. When he sees you in this four-armed form, immediately he'll know, yes, it's happened, and he'll try to kill you. So can you assume a childlike form? I can then try to hide you somewhere here in the prison. Maybe Kamsa won't try to kill you." He's Narayan. He doesn't even believe. Hidden anywhere by anybody. He's Narayan. He's got the weapons. So it's not rational, it's emotional. But it's a nice emotion. It's the parental affection of Devaki. That parental affection overwhelms her recognition of Krishna, Krishna, as the Supreme Lord. And then they don't have any association with Krishna for another 12 years. When he comes back, brought by Akrura, he kills a mad elephant in the wildest and intoxicated state of Kovalyapida. Just KOs him, knocks him out, breaks off his tusks, and put the tusks over his shoulder. Comes sauntering in to the wrestling arena. KOs Chanur and Mushtakan, pulls Kamsa off the throne and finished. And Kamsa's Kamsa became, got the position that he got because he was so powerful. It doesn't describe this in the Bhagavatam, but in Garga Samhita, it describes that all the kings, Kamsa defeated them within the inch of their life and said, either you surrender to me and assist me in my kingdom, or I'll kill you. I surrender, I surrender, I surrender. He was so powerful. So powerful, one punch. Vasudeva and Devaki saw the whole thing happen. They could understand, this isn't just our little boy. This is the personality of Godhead. And then Krishna approached them with outstretched arms. Krishna Balaram came. They hadn't seen their mother and father in 12 years. From the day one that Krishna was born. And Vasudeva and Devaki just stood there in awe and reverence. This is the Supreme Lord. So Krishna covered them with his yogamaya potency. They forgot that he was the Supreme Lord, and they embraced him. Smelled his head. Profuse tears, crying. Reunited with their child, their two boys, once again. And right away, okay, we've got to put you in school. You've been off playing with the cows, that's nice, but you've got to get some education. You're our son. We're going to send you to the best teacher, Sandipani Muni. We'll take you to the barber and shave you up, put a little sika, put on your tilak and kunti mal, and send you off to school. You're our son. Parental affection predominated. Madhurya predominated Aishwarya. what to speak of Vrindavan. And what to speak of the intensity of the love of the gopis for Krishna. The madhurya of the love of the gopis, the madhurya rasa in its fullest. So Queen Kunti was in a position something like Vasudeva and Devaki. In the beginning of, so this is 8th chapter, Canto 1, Kunti's prayers, very famous part of the Bhagavatam, very wonderful prayers and very important message, and I want to mainly emphasize one particular part. It's verses 26 and 27 of chapter 8. First canto, where Kunti says right at the very beginning, when she, so the scene is Krishna's leaving Hastinapur. Krishna came all the way from Dwarka to assist the Pandavas in their difficult situation, and Kurukshetra battle is over, Yudhisthira's enthroned as the king, grandfather Bhishma has passed, and Krishna is going back to Dwarka. No, don't go back to Dwarka. Stay here with us. But, so in the public area, all the chariots are assembled, all the infantry, all the dignitaries, all the ministers, all the elephants, everyone's ready to go. Krishna is bidding, doing the final farewells, and Queen Kunti, because she's the queen, she has access to wherever she wants to go. She weaves her way through the crowd and stands right before Krishna. And pleads with Krishna, please, don't go. Krishna smiles. And then Yudhisthira says, please stay for a few weeks longer. Krishna says, okay. Then I have to go. Because, so it's churning the mood of separation. Right in the beginning. And where's their separation without attachment? So Kunti has, she shows her attachment to Krishna by her behavior, but also by her speech. In very choice prayers, she, right at the very beginning, she says, you are the absolute truth. The absolute truth is the source of all things. Everything emanates from you. But you are so merciful, you enter into that which emanates from you as the super soul, the Lord of the heart, in the heart of every living being, and here you are standing before us. Imagine that realization. Inconceivable. Realizing the person who is in the heart of every living being is right here. Inconceivable. She realizes it fully. The part that she has a hard time with, she says, is the fact that you appear as my nephew. So you treat me with reverence like a son treats the mother, a nephew treats the aunt. You come before and bow, you're the super soul. You're coming before and bowing before me and treating me with respect. I can't relate to that. But even more so, that's something that I'm having to deal with. But what I can't understand at all is the parental affection of Mother Jasoda. The parental affection of Mother Jasoda is so strong that you, the absolute truth, the most powerful and almighty Supreme Lord, who's feared by feared personified, when Mother Jasoda holds a little stick in her hand, you become so afraid, you cry. Real tears. Not play acting crying. There's fear of the stick in Mother Jasoda's hand. I can't understand it. She just mentions it and goes on. In other words, the intensity, the point is this. There's intensities of love. And with those intensities of love, there's intensities of feeling. So then she goes, because one of the themes of her prayers, it's you follow the weave, and you can see the theme. The theme, it's different but similar to the theme of the previous chapter. There's a theme of feelingly taking shelter of the personality of Godhead. So, I'm drawing attention to that because Bhagavatam is bringing that into the foreground right at the very beginning. Not just mechanically, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, doing the do's and avoiding the don'ts, and that's what religion is, and you do the do's and you do the rituals and you avoid the bad things and do good things for people, and that makes you a religious person. That's not the message of the Bhagavatam. One does those things for sure, but one does those things feelingly taking shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now the situation is Krishna's leaving. Kunti's feeling, she's anticipating the anguish of separation. She doesn't want that separation. She wants Krishna to stay. What Krishna came for was to establish Yudhisthira as the emperor. Now he's the emperor. Krishna's leaving? Who needs emperorship? Take the kingdom back. We want Krishna. So in verse 26, she gives, and Prabhupada in the purport gives, a very clear understanding of how to feelingly take shelter of Krishna. Or that which blocks feelingly taking shelter of Krishna is having false shelters. So the verse is a very famous verse. Oh, so many of the verses are very famous. Janma Aishvarya Shruta Shri Veer Ayyamana Madhapaman. Narvayahat Abhidhatam Vai Tvam Akinchan of Gochara. Something like that. That's it. Naivar hatya vidhatam vai tvam akinchana gocharam. My lordship, you can easily be approached. But, there's always a but only by those who are materially exhausted. One who is on the path of material progress, trying to improve himself with respectable parentage, great opulence, high education, and bodily beauty, cannot approach you with sincere feeling. False shelters is the theme. False shelters includes the material conception of religion, where religion means you do good things and you don't hurt anybody, and from those good things and not hurting anybody you get piety, and then you get fruits from that piety, and then you can enjoy prosperously the fruits of those pieties that you did. You can enjoy in a good way in this life, and after this life you get an upgrade either into the heavenly planets or in a better situation of life after this life. That's Srimad Bhagavatam in the first three verses says this Bhagavatam kicks out that conception. Dharma Prodita Kaitavotra Paramo Nirmat Saranam Satam. This Bhagavatam speaks only about those things. Say it the other way around. If you're interested in accumulating material pieties in order to get a better position of enjoyment, don't bother to read any further. This is not going to be of any interest to you. Because this Bhagavatam is Kaitava Dharma. It's kicking out this other things. Prabhupada calls it cheating religion. Cheating in the sense that it robs the real value of this human form of life. human form of life, the value of this human form of life is not to get a better, greater sense gratification. The value of this human form of life is to solve the problem of birth and death and return to the position in the spiritual world. A very special opportunity. The Bhagavatam is meant specifically, not the other things that Vyasadeva described that he did, and Narada confirmed what he did in the beginning of the fifth chapter of this canto, how to fulfill material desires and connect them with religious rituals so that you can enjoy religiously. Queen Kunti is taking that same idea and expressing it this way. For if the fruit of all of our piety is we get great wealth, a big kingdom, and lots of power and influence, but we don't have you, useless. The empty feeling, something is wrong, feeling. It's the false shelter. Janma, these four categories, Janma, Aishvarya, Shuta, so good birth, opulence, wealth, how many people are chasing after that one? And to get it, Shuta, good education, take a look around the room and add up the number of hours that have been invested in developing one's education, you'd have a big pile. And Sri, beauty. Big industry here in America. Probably has a fair share in India too. People doing all kinds of things for making their bodies beautiful without going into the detailed descriptions of what people do to try to make their bodies beautiful. Or at least presentable. A little attractive. And finding a contentment in achieving those things. It's a false shelter. An honest person will recognize there's something missing. A person who is not honest with themselves is just very busy with trying to do it better or get more or something. The difference between a devotee, the seventh chapter is making that clear, distinction between high birth, Ashvatthama, high learning, Ashvatthama, no shelter in Krishna. So what does he use his resources for? Whatever is convenient. Without any careful, as Prabhupada writes in the purport, immature contemplation. The Bhagavatam is for persons who are thoughtful. I remember hearing Prabhupada saying this. It really struck me. Krishna consciousness is for persons who are thoughtful. He used the word munishinam. He was explaining this word. Most people, just life passes by and they don't think about it. Some persons think about it, but they don't do anything about it. And Krishna consciousness is for persons who are very thoughtful, and they hear the words of the absolute truth coming from the pure devotee, and they act on it. It takes, some people say that spiritual life is for weak-minded people. It actually, in this age, to be a spiritual person, you have to be very strong. Because there's a lot of the other thing going on. We're in Prabhupada's language, the atmosphere is surcharged with opposition. Where's the support for persons who want to use this human form of life for its intended purpose? Where do you go? Where do you find even someone that has a clue what that is, but to speak of other people that are doing it? There's a lot of negative reinforcers around. So, in fact, one has to be very strong in their intelligence. Krishna gives that strong intelligence, the dhami buddhi yogam kam. When he sees tesham satata yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam, with affection, with real feeling. But as long as there's false shelters, you cannot have that feeling. Now let me read what Prabhupada writes in the purport. I hope you sense I'm getting excited about this subject, because it's an important subject. It's right at the beginning of Vyasadeva's. He's just done the six chapters of build-up, and now he's giving the thing. He's giving the essence messages right at the front end. How to feelingly take this subject and bring it into your heart and live by it, and not be carried away by the current of Kali Yuga. Because that's what's going on. Look to your left, look to your right. People are getting swept away by this terrible age. Good people are getting washed away. Not only by tidal waves. By the whole age of Kali. People are just... So here's what Prabhupada writes in the purport. When I read Prabhupada's purports, I try to think, Prabhupada is the empowered acharya. There has never been such an empowered acharya to deliver people to a stage of pure devotion in the history of the world. So he's taking this prayer of Queen Kunti, and he's writing for the next 10,000 years, writing to the whole, his audience is the whole world. It's not a few people. It's the whole world. He knows this is going to be translated into many languages and distributed to thousands and millions, hundreds of thousands and millions of people. So what great contemplation he's putting behind delivering these words. Purport. Being materially advanced means taking birth in an aristocratic family and possessing great wealth and education and attractive personal beauty. All materialistic men and women are mad after possessing these material opulences, and this is known as advancement of material civilization. But the result is that by possessing these material assets, one becomes artificially puffed up, intoxicated by such temporary possessions. Consequently, such materially puffed up persons are incapable of uttering the holy name of Krishna by addressing him feelingly. Oh Krishna, oh Krishna, oh Govinda. It is said in the Shastras that by once uttering the holy name of the Lord, once, the sinner gets rid of a quantity of sins and he is unable to commit. That's pretty succinct. Sometimes says, lifetimes and lifetimes and how many sins? Try to commit as many as you can. We don't recommend this. As many as you can. And still, with once chanting the holy name. Then he says it three times more. Such is the power of uttering the holy name of the Lord. There is not the least exaggeration in the statement, in the third time. Actually, the Lord's holy name has such powerful potency. Boom, boom, boom. But there is a quality to such utterances also. It is the deliverance from one's sins. It depends on the quality of feeling. A helpless man can feelingly utter the holy name of the Lord, whereas a man who utters the same holy name in great material satisfaction cannot be so sincere. He says it again. A materially puffed up person may utter the holy name of the Lord occasionally, but he is incapable of uttering the holy name in quality. So, false shelters. One sense that this is now describing through Queen Quinty's words and Prabhupada's wonderful, powerful purport is anartha nivritti. Those of you that are studying Nectar Devotion, you know this term. The eradication of unwanted things from the heart. Nivritti is removal, annihilation, eradication. And anartha is things unwanted. Artha is things wanted. Dharma artha. Kama moksha. Artha, literally it means things that are wanted. Because most people want money. So artha has that, well, connotation. But it literally it means things wanted. And anartha means things unwanted. Anartha nivritti is the eradication of false shelters. What's a false shelter? A sense of well-being, contentedness. I'm okay because now with the fruit of my piety I have this and that and that and that and this. But what happens is a little shift of the material energy and poof, it's gone. Just like that. And then where does that leave that person who is hoping to find happiness in that shelter? Their bubble just is burst. And it happens in the form of calamities. And we have our recent calamities and our more distant calamities, but calamities makes it starkly obvious. And then there's the little things that happen to us all the time. We're hoping, we've got a plan, we've got our happiness program all laid out, the kaleidoscope turns. You know what a kaleidoscope is? The kaleidoscope turns and the picture just changed. We didn't even know who turned the kaleidoscope, it just turned. And then it's something else. And we wanted to go back to where it was, but it doesn't go back because it's a new picture. During the feast or prasadam that we had at our Vyasa Puja function, one of the devotees at the table told me that he had heard and he watched part of the CNN presentation on the tsunami, whatever it's, you know, disaster. And the way that it was at one of those TV talk shows, because our dear President of the United States requested two people to head an international fundraising thing for the tsunami victims. And one of them was the former president, Bill Clinton, and his father, or senior. At least that's what I understand. So, because Bill Clinton has been on lots of talk shows, he thought one of the ways to do this would be to get on a talk show. And the format of the talk show was he invited religious leaders from many different denominations or representations of world religions to speak their views on. The question that was asked was, how can such a thing happen? Not what to do about it, but how did it happen? And the person who was speaking to me said, I wasn't impressed by anything that anybody had to say. with the exception of Bill Clinton. I said, really? What did Bill Clinton have to say? He said, well, there were two things that stood out. One of them was that Bill Clinton said, what we can understand from this is there's a power far greater than any one of us. And what struck this devotee was, here's a person who was perhaps, one might say, the most powerful controller on the planet for a number of years. And if they had allowed him, he would have extended. And likely he would have won it. His realization is, there's a controller more powerful than any of us. So, false shelters means to think otherwise. If I set my life up with this and this and this, you know, one rationale that I recently heard somebody say, then I can perform my Krishna consciousness very nicely. The performing of Krishna consciousness very nicely is depending upon this and this and this. It's never going to happen because this and this always get jiggled around. Tossed around, turned around, upside down, and it's not stable. It's asat. What the stik, that there's no happiness in it, it's a false shelter. It's the same principle of Prabhupada speaking to Bhakti Siddhanta when Bhakti Siddhanta told him upon their first meeting, go to the West and speak the message of Chaitanya. Prabhupada gave his argument, the Gandhi argument, we can do that. Who'll pay attention to us while India is still under the subjugation of British rule? First, we have to have this in place. We have to remove the British rule from India. Then when we go abroad, people will pay attention. Bhaktisiddhanta dismissed that argument altogether. Spiritual well-being is not dependent upon material well-being. The other way around. And one who thinks my well-being is made up of the configuration of the fruits of my piety positioned so nicely, that's a fool's paradise that will soon come crashing down in small pieces or all at once. So Queen Kunti knows that. Her son's the emperor. She should be happy, right? They've been in exile for so long and cheated and so forth and so on. So her son's now the rightful emperor once again, and all the enemies Krishna has removed. They have clear sailing ahead. No problema. And she doesn't want it. She wants shelter in Krishna. She wants to feelingly bhajatam priti purvakam. She wants to receive that dadami bodhi yogam tam. She wants to receive that which will bring her straight to Krishna, because it has to be with feelingly executed calling upon Krishna. And that, so the message is, that's not going to happen as long as there's false shelters, and we all have false shelters. We all have them. And when we pray to Krishna, please, this is a theme that I was speaking over this past weekend, please take from my heart all other desires except for shelter in your loving devotional service. We've got our fingers on certain things that we don't want Krishna to touch. We got locked up. We definitely have our conditions of surrender. And what we don't want to surrender. We're holding on. to the material energy asking for Krishna's shelter. And when Krishna tugs at what we're holding on to, we say, ouch. Please don't tug onto what I'm holding on to. That's not what I meant. You didn't understand my instructions very well. We cannot get the fullness of Krishna's shelter as long as we're holding on to false shelters. And the process, this is right at the early part of the first canto of Vyasadeva's teaching. What the message of the Bhagavatam is through the mouth of Queen Kunti. Unless one has exclusive shelter, and it takes the first time to get to that stage, exclusive shelter in Krishna. But as long as we have so many other shelters, the feeling of our relationship with Krishna, the loving feelings of being connected to Krishna in genuine love, will not appear in our heart. And we'll have something. We'll have piety and fruits of piety and, you know, good behavior, and that's good. It's good. But it's not going to be satisfying. The Bhagavatam's message is clear from the beginning. Nena na supersedati. Ahoituki apratiyata yayatma supersedati. What's the essence of the message of all the scriptures? Engagement in devotional service where there's no hetu, there's no motivation, and there's no interruption. It doesn't stop. Unceasing flow of selfless devotion to the personality of Godhead, and you grab on to false shelters and you won't experience that. So that's in the second chapter, the verse I just quoted. Here Queen Kunti is explaining it in the eighth chapter. It's a theme of the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam is to give us the full light of Krishna, the fullness of Krishna's being present on this planet, walking, placing his lotus feet on the soft soil of Vrindavan, making everything replete with opulence, peace, beauty, everything desirable. And in Krishna's absence, where is that shelter to be found? It's here. It's here. If we're eager, we'll hear that message and we'll take that message in and we'll be uplifted by that message. If we're eager to receive that. So Krishna will ask us, are you sure that you're eager? What about this little attachment and false shelter you have over there? What if I... Oh, no.
Not that, please, no. Maybe later.
Let me chant a little longer. I'll think about it.
Okay. Let me know. Krishna knows. She's like an acharya for us. Her prayers are very acharya-like. She's holding that light, showing her own heart. And by showing her own heart, she's showing what's in our heart. How to feelingly approach Krishna in whatever way he wants, on his terms, take those things from our heart and give us his full shelter. And even if it's, incrementally little progressions toward that stage, fine. But move toward that position. Recognize that's the message of the Bhagavatam. That alone is going to satisfy us. And the Bhagavatam has the potency to take us all the way. This very powerful message of Srimad Bhagavatam, delivered by the lips of the pure devotee, Shukadeva Goswami, repeated by our disciple succession. Any discussion?
A question? I read it over and over. Which in Srila Jiva Goswami Thunderbird, in the early part he mentioned that if you are not a devotee of Krishna, don't raise.
Yeah, it's similar to the statement at the beginning of the Bhagavatam. Mm. Acharyas explain like this. Baladev Vidyagusan has commented on that. Baladev Vidyagusan says that Jiva Goswami is making it very clear to his devotee reader that this is devotional. And to the non-devotee reader, if you're looking for something other than devotion, you need not go further. Now he says something heavier than you need not go further, but that's the message. He's very upfront about it. Here's a written question. Could you kindly explain what, quote, feelingly means when one should feelingly take shelter of Krishna? How can I feelingly take shelter of the Lord with all the anarthas in my heart? In other words, I understand from the question, it's the catch-22 question. Yeah, since I can't feelingly take shelter as long as I have anarthas in the heart, I have anarthas in the heart, so how can I feelingly do that, since I can't, because I have anarthas in my heart? Which comes first? So, the answer to that is twofold. There's the descending mercy factor, which is the most important. Let me read. Out of his causeless mercy only to reclaim the fallen souls who are captivated by the illusory energy. Material existence is something like a blazing forest fire, which can be extinguished by the mercy of Lord Sri Krishna. Where is Himangi?
She's watching on the
television. Watching on the TV?
Yeah.
I didn't know it was on TV. Okay. Let's talk eye contact here. We've heard this samsara da na na na. So that's the where the reference is from. So this material existence is compared to blazing, not just samanarthas in the heart, the blazing fire. And how can you put out a blazing forest fire, down torrential downpours of rain, not just a little bucketful here and there? The spiritual master is the mercy representative of the Lord. Where does that downpour of rain come from?
Lord.
The representative of the Lord. The spiritual master is the mercy representative of the Lord. Therefore, a person burning in the flames of material existence may receive the rains of mercy of the Lord through the transparent medium of the self-realized spiritual master. So, the spiritual master, by his words, can penetrate into the heart of the suffering person and inject transcendental knowledge, which alone can extinguish the fire of material existence. It's like a warhead in the form of sound vibration, and that if one opens one's heart to those words, then it explodes. But this is the other way around. It's taking heat and changing heat, or taking the anarthas and transforming the anarthas into vapor by transcendental knowledge. But transcendental knowledge is not just information. We can repeat words. We can train a parrot to repeat words. But the taking shelter of those words, then it's not dependent upon how much strength you have or how anartha-free you are. It's the openness to that downpour. It's the mercy is Krishna. That's to be understood. It's Krishna. Krishna in the form of his downpour of mercy, and he makes the arrangement by giving transcendental knowledge into the heart of those who want to extinguish material existence. They want to become anartha-free. It's that downpour of mercy in the form of the words. By his words, the words penetrate into the heart of the suffering person and inject transcendental knowledge. So transcendental knowledge is, once again, it's meant to be something you live by, not just something that, like an academic thing, you can repeat when someone pushes the button. 2 + 2 = 4. A, B, C. And so it's not that kind of knowledge, but will you take it within and live by it? So it's added strength that comes from Krishna's mercy, recognizing that you, despite the disqualification, you want that mercy of Krishna. You want that relationship with Krishna. Then he sends the missiles to put out the material existence, the downpour of mercy. And what we need to do from our side is just be eager for it. And our eagerness for it is a measure of that is our gratitude, and our gratitude is shown by how we apply. Consistently apply. And because we have these things in our heart, we're not so consistent. That's understood. Because we're going to school. We're not professors. We're going to school. We're learning. If Prahlad, you're trying to train him something, and he doesn't always perfectly get that something, you don't give up on him. He's Prahlad. He's going to do, but you're in a very affectionate, motherly way. You persist in training, and if the receptivity is right, then I was watching one very nice devotee couple with their small boy, there was an electrical thing. And she just, he reached for it. And she just raised her finger and went like that. And he stopped. Now, I could, actually, many children, all they need to do is have somebody say no. And that's the reason to do it. But because the child is receiving such affection, when just, that's all it took. I was really impressed. She didn't even bother to like put it away and hide it so he can't see it. She left it there. She just, that's all it took. And he came back again, and he looked at it, looked at his mother. She didn't even have to do it. So it's having a strength that's beyond our own strength, and the eagerness for that, specifically our relationship with Krishna, restoring the proper loving relationship with Krishna, despite our disqualifications to have that. If Krishna removes those things, then we can feel them often. It's all in Prabhupada's books. Everything in the books. Everything. From all different angles. Very, very carefully, very expertly. Very wonderfully presented. Anything further? Srikant?
Regarding the removal of the call shelter, can you say the point like how we should do it? It should be done gradually or with guidance or how exactly it should be done?
How exactly should which be done? Training of?
The removal of call shelter.
The mode of?
Removal of
false shelters.
Removal of false shelters, okay. The answer that you're going to get, I'll just pull out one of my flashcards. I'm an incrementalist. So my answer will be that kind of an answer. I believe in little steps, but I believe very, very, very much in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's teaching that progress is a series of little steps made in the right direction. Firm believer in that. So yes. And I'll give you some practical suggestions how to be a good incrementalist, an effective one. Take a little inventory of the false shelters that you're aware of. There's probably zillions more, but at least the ones that you're aware of. Identify one that you think you can like do without. Pick an easy one. Have a series of small victories before you try for some of the bigger ones. And then after you successfully and take some help from somebody else that can be like a, you know, the buddy system that you hold yourself accountable to, or a superior that you hold yourself accountable to, and you report to them, here's where I messed up. And then little success, and little success, little success. Oh, I messed up again. Little success, little success. I'm really determined. Wow, I can do it. Then go back to your list. Take another one, a doable one. Now, let me ask you a question. What are you going to do with the answer I just gave you? You don't have to answer it right now, but you have to answer it. Because application is really what makes the difference between progressing and not progressing. And it's a lot easier to apply when there's association with someone who, when there's explicitly taking some help from you. There's not only your strength, but their strength. Not only your honest self-honesty, but theirs also. It will strengthen the relationships that you have by being honest and giving and taking. Both. Anything else?
Yeah. You answered to Hemangi Mataji's question. You said there are great gratitude is shown by how we apply the instructions that we get.
That's one of the measures,
And that too consistently.
So
how to apply them consistently? That's my question, how to have that focus.
Just by deciding. How to is by deciding to. Remind me, and I'll send you a little thing that just came up about commitment. All that it takes is the commitment to do so. And then it becomes the how-to is solved. Because it's not, going back to her question, or the question she raised, it's not on our strength, but it's the divine descending mercy of the Supreme Lord that empowers that decision. That's our Christian, that's where our Christian realization comes in. Because we're devotees, we don't just do apart from Krishna. We do dependent upon Krishna. And the Krishna factor pushes us beyond our own tiny little capacity. And we realize that it's Krishna. And that's what we want. It's not just getting on the other side of the thing. We want our relationship with Krishna. That's what we want. And Krishna picks us up and carries us on the other side of that thing. And we have our relationship with Krishna too, which is really what we want. The how-to is the commitment. It's the proper exercise of our free will. That's all we can do. And then we make our little endeavors accordingly. I was discussing this with a teenager who asked the question recently. They asked this question, what if what we have to offer is embarrassingly paltry? We're just ashamed of how feeble is this effort and the shape of the effort. Don't worry about that. Just keep practicing it and Krishna will make it wonderful effort. Stronger and stronger and better and better. And that's Krishna's department. You worry about your offering. Offer with feeling. Try. The relationship that one has with representatives of Krishna becomes critical in coming to that stage of our loving relationship with Krishna. Critical. Prabhupada calls it the secret to success in spiritual life. The it's such a secret. He's declaring it openly, and people still don't get it. It's such a secret.
Yeah. The follow-up question to what you were saying to me, the attachment to the false shelter, is it because we get some sense of kind of a comfort feeling, self-pity?
Exactly. That's what shelter means. But if it's something that's impermanent. Wind. The floor is shaking. Earthquake. Now it's changing. It was supposed to be like this, and now it's not like this anymore. False shelter. If we trust in Krishna, Krishna can change the configuration of the material energy however he likes. It's fine with me. I'll adjust. I'm a servant. I just want that relationship with Krishna. I can serve him this way. I can serve him that way. He can keep it the same. He can change it. Whatever he wants. Now, you have a great opportunity for learning in the form of having a small child. Your small child is fully dependent. And you're not going to turn the child upside down and shake him, because, I mean, if you playfully move it, he's okay. He's not going to panic because he's in the arms of his mother. He's not going to do anything that's going to jeopardize his well-being. Krishna's not going to do that with you either. If things change, it's fine. It's fine. Whatever it is, whatever the configuration is, it's fine. Because of the trust in Krishna. But if it's, you know, my happiness is dependent upon things being like that instead of like this, the narration that I gave about the Chirgat Lila, for me that's very neat. That's the same message. The gopis wanted, Krishna said, what if it looks like this? And they teased, Krishna teased them, they teased Krishna. But if Krishna wants it like this, then it's like this. And so if Krishna wants, it's like Krishna wants. What Krishna wants is not this or that. What Krishna wants is our love. That's what Krishna wants. And if something shifts, Krishna's wanting our love. We are attached to something else besides giving our love to Krishna. Krishna's giving us a chance to find that position of our loving relationship with Krishna, with him, and act accordingly. That's the opportunity we're being given each step. The same message that Krishna Lila was giving in her seminar. Just say yes to Krishna. This is his arrangement. Trust in the love of Krishna. Anything else? Yeah. It seems that there's some benefit to sit in the front row up here. Go ahead.
Is taking false shelter and attachment be the same?
It's a different way of saying the same thing. Slightly different meaning, but slightly different meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Mataji was asking about the comfort zone. It appears like a cycle, like and once I do like any kind of spiritual activity, it means like okay, I'm away from the false shelter, and again the comfort zone comes. Again, I'm away, and again the cycle appears to be coming. So is this because of the anathas again? Is this because of the anathas again?
Yeah, it's our strong habits of material conditioning. One devotee calls them bungee cords. You know what bungee cords are? You've seen? They have that little metal hook, and then an elastic thing, and then a metal hook. Those are called bungee cords. You can buy them in a hardware store. So, something moves out of place, the bungee cords pull it back into place. So our material attachments, our conditioning, we may try to move away from that. We get some exhilarating experience and realization and highball, and then material conditioning pulls us back into the same old. What happened? it's our long standing involvement with the material energy. When we slacken in our, this is Bhakti Siddhanta's language, when we slacken in submission to Krishna, we fall again to the patterns of our conditioning behavior with all the emotions and forms of patterns of speech and behaviors. And it may take some time before we realize, oh, I'm conditioned again. I'm that same space that I was in before. So generally speaking, it's a gradual process. Prabhupada was asked, how long does it take, Swamiji? How long does it take to become Krishna conscious? Prabhupada answered, less than a moment. And in that less than a moment, two things. Sense gratification and mental speculation. Okay. Generally people are attached to these things, and therefore generally it's a gradual process. But it's, we get pulled back by those conditioned things because we're attached to those things. We're attached to things that are grabbing our throat and choking us, causing us to be unable to breathe. We're suffocating for lack of oxygen, and we keep doing it to ourselves voluntarily due to lack of taking shelter of the spiritual energy, the descending mercy that comes from Krishna to take us out of that position. Krishna wants us out of that position. The mother that raised her finger and went just like that didn't want her son playing with the power box. But because he trusted his mother, she didn't have to say a word. She didn't even make a face. She just raised her finger and moved it. He stopped. That's a loving relationship. And he didn't go back to go forward with them again. So. We don't have to go back to those conditioned spaces. If we slacken in our submission, we will. Just by material conditioning. Until there's these two energies, spiritual energy and material energy. We take a little siesta from Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada gave a lecture on this, or spoke on this point in a lecture. He said that it's not that sometimes a devotee will think, I've surrendered so much to Krishna, I need a little break. There's no break from devotional service. Because as soon as there's a break from devotional service, it's not that the way the Prabhupada explained it was, okay, like material activity, I engage in work and I want weekend off. I want vacation. I work hard, I want to sankalpa vikalpa. But it's not that you have to then say, okay, Maya, now you can come. Prabhupada said, immediately Maya is there. You turn your attention from light, and immediately there's shadow, there's not any delay. Immediately Maya is there when you slacken in your submission to Krishna, to Guru and Krishna. Immediately. The conditioned tendencies are there. So then, the remedy is stay in the... stay in that position. Stay in that position of giving your attention to Krishna with feeling. Okay, thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada.
Lord and Excellent Swami Maharaj,
yes.